Clyden from the Max Lake Institute in Jena. And that's a very bold sounding title.
Yeah. So I couldn't think of anything else. It's actually a manuscript that I've been working on for over a year now. Yes, thanks very much, and also thanks for the opportunity to talk here. So, you see the title. It doesn't really say MEP in there, or maximum entry production, but you'll see where MEP comes in on the way. And actually where I want to start is actually with a little bit of my own motivation of why I, or how I got into MEP or thermodynamics, and that's actually through the Gaia hypothesis. Some of you may know from that was proposed by Jim Lovelock in the 70s that the Earth is a superorganism regulating itself so that it's most advantageous to life. And when you go back in the literature to the 60s, there was in the mid-60s, there was a paper by Lovelock on how you can actually detect life on a planet, and he referred to as probably the clearest sign for life on a widespread life on the planet is actually chemical disequilibrium in its atmosphere. And so that relates to non-equilibrium thermodynamics, so you're in a state that is away from thermodynamic equilibrium. And so when you actually look at disequilibrium, and let's say oxygen concentration in the atmosphere is a indication for disequilibrium. You can see here a reconstruction by de Collin from Harvard over the last 3.8 billion years, and you can see that this is today, so the oxygen concentration in the atmosphere most likely has increased through the history, and so that looks like that actually the Earth evolved away from equilibrium, and that sort of seems like, well, that doesn't quite fit with the second law of thermodynamics. And then on the other hand, you have MEP, so maximum entropy production, which seems to suggest that you approach equilibrium as fast as possible. And now you can think, well, how do these two actually fit together? I mean, it seems like that's a contradiction. I mean, this is something that is pretty robust. I mean, it's reconstructed without any notion of thermodynamics. It's just, you know, the concentration, the inferred concentration of oxygen in the past atmosphere. Okay, so that was my motivation, if you want, Earth system science, the effect of life on the planet. But then I also actually included here a few slides that I think probably fit more in the context of this workshop in terms of stochastic forcing and so on. Doing simple models with stochastic forcing and bifurcation and so on. When you think about variability or stochastic forcing, temporal variability, or spatial heterogeneity, then you can associate that also with disequilibrium, because in thermodynamic equilibrium everything is gray and smooth and boring, and you only get gradients in space and time if you actually are maintained in a state away from equilibrium. So thermodynamic equilibrium means that your variables are uniform and constant, and away from equilibrium means that you have spatial and temporal variability. What I will be talking about is that actually what you need to get to disequilibrium is actually that you need to generate power in a system, physical power or chemical power, to maintain your disequilibrium. And then, of course, that relates to the question of where is the power coming from the forcing of the Earth system. Okay, so this is sort of the overarching question then that I want to attempt to address here to some extent, is sort of how does the Earth system generate and maintain thermodynamic disequilibrium? And then also more on the applied direction of why should we care about it. So this is my outline. So I give first a sort of really basic introduction. I mean, this is sort of almost elementary high school, college level thermodynamics on, you know, how do you maintain disequilibrium. I have some simple toy models that I use to sort of, something, you know, for your self-education that you actually understand how that works. And then I also talk about, you know, power generation, how you can actually use gradients to extract power, and also talk about you know, you're probably familiar with the Carnot efficiency of equilibrium thermodynamics, and I'll show that actually when you talk about the Earth system, you deal with maximum efficiencies that are much less than the Carnot efficiency. Oops, no, hang on, there was one more item there, right? Oh yeah, then apply this on to the Earth system, and talk about how power is generated, but also how it is transferred from one thermodynamic variable to another, which sort of builds up a hierarchy, if you want, where you know, power is generated here by radiative gradients, and then it trickles down to some other variables, and also how it connects to maximization. And then the last point is about the implications. Okay, so this is hopefully that some of you are familiar with the first and second law of thermodynamics. So the first law states that your change of internal energy is related to external heat sources dq and work done by the system or work done on the system, the dw. And the second law stating that, you know, when the entropy of a system can only increase of an isolated system. So to illustrate this, this is a really simple two-box model where we have, do we have a pointer? Oh, here's a stick that works. It's a really simple model, an isolated system, so we have no fluxes across the boundary. We have one box that's initially, say, hot, and one that's cold. You have a certain entropy in the system, and you have a flux of heat between these boxes, and we write this flux as just a conductivity times the temperature gradient. And then when you do the first law, well, you don't deal with work here in the system, so you don't have external heating, so you just deal with changes of internal energy of the two boxes are related to this heat flux, so the heat goes away from this flux, from this box, and is being added to that box. And when you add these together, then you get zero, so there's no external heating or cooling. The second law, you can write down the balance equations for entropy, so how entropy changes with time. With this heat flux, you export heat with this temperature, and you add this entropy to this box. And so in this process of balancing out the temperature gradient, you actually produce entropy, so that means that your total entropy of the system, this is the heat flux times the inverse of the temperature, hope that should be capital T here. So I use this also as sigma, so entropy production by that heat flux. That's greater or equal to zero, and that's the second law, if you want, what it says. And so you can just do that in a spreadsheet to calculate what's going to happen. So you initialize it with a temperature gradient, and that temperature gradient disappears in time because of the heat flux, but the heat flux also disappears in time. The entropy production declines in time. The entropy of the one box decreases, the other one increases, and the total entropy of the system, you can see a slight increase, and so then here one is the state of maximum entropy state thermodynamic equilibrium, where then both temperatures are the same. Okay, nice and well. So, in other words, an initial temperature gradient is dissipated to a state of thermodynamic equilibrium that's just following the second law. And so then you can say now, of course, how are you able to maintain gradients in steady state? And so what you need for that is that you need to have some exchange. So if you think of this as being the Earth system, then you need some exchange, for instance, with space. So you exchange radiation of different entropies. Solar radiation comes in, thermal radiation goes out. So when you account for these fluxes here, and I mean, do again energy balances for these two boxes. I didn't write them down here because they're getting longer. But so the main idea here is that because you have exchange fluxes across the boundary, and the exchange takes place at different temperatures, you actually can maintain a temperature gradient in steady state. And your heat flux declines initially, but it also assumes a non-zero constant value at the end, so you reach a steady state, steady heat flux, a steady temperature gradient. And your total entropy increases, but I mean, it's hard to see here, but it's not quite at the maximum, it's a little below the maximum entropy. your entropy production also declines and reaches some steady state here. Okay, so so in other words, you can maintain a state of thermodynamic disequilibrium if you can have exchange fluxes across the system boundary. Now you can think about, well, okay, so we have the first and second law, but how can you actually really characterize disequilibrium? Because the entropy of a system relates also to the overall heat content, and you can actually use entropy to quantify disequilibrium just by really just simply reforming or just replacing the dq here, the heating, by the first law, and then you get, you know, just du, so the change of internal heat versus the work done or by the system. And when you expand this, you can basically say, well, this is sort of an entropy that's related to heat content. And the other one is the one that actually relates to disequilibrium, or relate to how much work is done on the system or by the system, depending on which direction it goes. And so you could interpret this here as an entropy that really characterizes the disequilibrium. If you do this a little further, then you can actually again rewrite this to solve for dW, and then actually what you get is just the expression for Helmholtz free energy. So in other words, when you have disequilibrium, it means that you have Helmholtz free energy in the system. So if you do this all in time, so if you take time derivatives, then you actually have here the first law then becoming sort of the change of internal energy in time is your net heating or cooling minus how much power is extracted, plus the dissipation that occurs in the system. The second law is basically a balance equation of the entropy with time. So the change of entropy with time is how much entropy is produced within the system minus how much is being exchanged with the surroundings. And then you also have a balance equation here that describes how your free energy in the system is being changing in time. So you add free energy by extracting power from a heating gradient, and you dissipate free energy by some irreversible process, and that depletes your disequilibrium. Again, you can apply these formulations to the two models that I just showed you, these example models, and then you can see here, so this isolated system where your disequilibrium was dissipated in time, you can actually see this disequilibrium is initially negative, and then it approaches zero. And your free energy also vanishes to zero. Here, this is the free energy scale, and this is the entropy scale. In the non-isolated system, so where you exchange energy at the system boundary, your disequilibrium initially is decreased as well, but you maintain some form of disequilibrium. That's the temperature gradient that we could see, we saw in the earlier slides. While your free energy decreases and reaches a steady constant value. So when you take these three equations together, then and you want to then later on apply this to the Earth system, so you have some external fluxes that result in heating gradients that can allow you to extract power from these gradients that then adds to generate free energy and disequilibrium, then irreversible processes always aim to dissipate this disequilibrium and balance out gradients, which, hang on, it's a sort of stepwise slide here. So that results in entropy production. So that ends in here. So it's getting towards a spaghetti diagram here. At the same time, you also have dissipative heating, so that adds to the first law. And in the end, the entropy that you produce, you can reject, or is limited by the ability to reject entropy by net entropy exchange with the surroundings. And so, but then also with the free energy that you have, you can actually alter this here. And I mean, I'll give you the example of generation of kinetic energy that can balance out radiative gradients at the planetary scale and can derive free energy by doing that. But anyway, so when you look at this line diagram here, so you can see that the power that you extract from a gradient in a, from the first law is driving the disequilibrium. So you have a relationship between how much power you can extract with the disequilibrium, but then with irreversible processes taking place, you have a connection between disequilibrium and entropy production. And so if you want to speak about maximum entropy production, how you apply it to the Earth system, I think you have to think about it in this broader terms of, you know, how much power can you extract to drive a process that can accelerate entropy production in the system. So now I want to talk about, or focus more on the power that you can extract from a gradient. I will actually start with the derivation of the Carnot efficiency, which probably most or some of you are familiar with. And so again, we look at the first and second law. Let's say we have a box that we heat on the one side with a certain heat flux, and so it's at a certain temperature. And here you have an outflux, and it leaves the heat leaves with a certain temperature, T out. And then you want to extract some work per time, so you dW dt, so it's the power that you extract here. And you can just write down the balance equations for this system. So in other words, the first law just becomes here that the difference in the heat fluxes is equal to the power that is being extracted. Then the second law, so the entropy budget, tells you that you have some import of entropy associated with this flux here, and you have an export of entropy associated with this flux. And by using the energy balance, you can replace J out by Jn minus P, the extracted power. And the second law requires that this is greater or equal to zero. This, so there's no entropy being exported here. And so this needs to be greater or equal to zero. And so the limit, of course, is when you assume that this is zero. And then you can derive actually from that the power you can extract, and that is then just, you know, reform, throw over the terms and so on, and then what you get is just that the maximum power you can extract is proportional to the flux, but also to the difference in temperatures. Oh, this is the typical expression for the Carnot efficiency. So at the Carnot efficiency limit, this is equal, but it comes at the assumption that there are no other irreversible processes taking place in the system. It also assumes that the temperature gradient remains fixed. And that's actually, you can't assume that when you apply to the Earth system. So what you have, and I mean, I give you some examples in the following, is that the temperature gradient responds to the flux. The greater the flux, the less the temperature gradient. Also, when you want to extract power from a radiative gradient, you also compete with other irreversible processes. You compete with diffusion or radiative exchange that also tries to dissipate this gradient. And last but not least, of course, when you extract power, then you also dissipate it. And so to close the energy balance, you actually need to add this energy back into the energy balance. But then actually what you will see is that this expression here is actually way too high. I mean, it's actually a lot less that you can extract. So again, I come back to this simple two-box model. It's actually, in its setup, very similar to what I think Roderick probably showed on Monday, is this two-box model of the climate system where you say, let's say, this is the tropical box and this is the polar region, and then you have heat transport by the atmospheric circulation. So here you have then a stronger solar forcing in the tropics than you have in the polar regions, and you have cooling by emission of long-wave radiation. So again, you can write down the first law. So this is the change of heat content in the hot box and the cold box is then related to the influx of solar radiation heating these two, the cooling by emission of radiation, long-wave radiation, and you have this heat exchange between those two boxes. The second law is the entropy balance, so you write your total change of entropy of the system as the entropy change in this box plus the one of this box. And then you have some terms that produce entropy, for example, or this term here is the mixing of this heat with this temperature. This term here is the mixing of this heat with this temperature that produces entropy. Then you have the heat, the entropy production by the balancing, by the heat exchange between the two boxes. And then you have, then this entropy production is balanced in steady state with the net entropy exchange by the fluxes, by the radiative fluxes across the boundary. And so then you can write down actually an expression when you fill in these terms, then you actually get that the entropy production due to heat transport between the two boxes, just the heat flux times the inverse of the temperature difference, the difference in the temperature inverse, or this. Then you can use the first laws to express the temperature gradient in terms of the fluxes. So when you express the long wave cooling as a linearized form, A plus B times T, then, KB, I call it Boltzmann cooling or something, then you can express it in terms of the difference in solar heating, minus 2 times the heat flux here, just by taking the difference of these two, I think. Yeah. So then you can use this expression of the temperature gradient, put it in there. Then entropy production by heat transport is dissipation by temperature, so in steady state dissipation equals power, and so you can actually re-express this in form of power. The power you can extract from this gradient is proportional to this heat flux, and then you have here this expression of the temperature gradient. And so you see that this expression here is quadratic in the heat flux, and so it has a maximum value. You can just, I mean, this is, if you neglect that this temperature depends on the heat fluxes as well, but I mean, it's not that strongly dependent, so you ignore this dependence and you can maximize it. And what you find then in the end is actually that the power that you can extract from this gradient here is proportional to the differential solar heating times something that looks like the Carnot efficiency of the temperatures at radiative equilibrium. So these are the temperatures at radiative equilibrium, but divided by 8. Yeah, so it's, you can see it, well, it's almost an order of magnitude less than what you would get from a Carnot efficiency. Now, this factor of 8 actually comes from the fact that here's a 2 there. That's by combining these two equations, you get a 2. Then the optimum temperature gradient that is associated with maximum power extraction is half the temperature gradient at radiative equilibrium. That's another factor of 2. And then you can only extract half the flux between the differences. Actually, I show this here in this diagram as well. So this is here just, again, a spreadsheet implementation of this model. So here you vary the heat flux and see how this simple two-box model reacts. So as you increase the heat flux, your temperature gradient disappears. Also, here this is, the entropies of the two boxes and the total entropy of the system. Here is entropy production and the power you extract, and here you see this maximum power at actually a quarter of the solar radiative forcing. And you see, it's non-distinguishable here whether you maximize power or whether you maximize entropy production. And that's because the 1 over T doesn't really matter much if you divide it by 1 over 300 or 1 over 288. So it's almost the same. It's not exactly the same, but almost the same. And you wouldn't notice, in practical terms, you wouldn't notice a difference. And then you can also look at this disequilibrium and the free energy in the system. So again, so this is a factor of 4 that reduces the efficiency, and then here the temperature difference is half the one at radiative equilibrium, so that's another factor of 2, so that's why it's 1 over 8. Yeah, and so if you put in these numbers here, so this is centigrade, but if you convert them into Kelvin and calculate this, then you actually notice that the maximum efficiency of extracting power from the radiative forcing is only 1.8%. You know, and it sounds like it's really not efficient, but it's the best you can do because the power extraction from this radiative gradient competes with these other processes that also try to dissipate that gradient. So actually, when you put this in terms of watts, then actually what you get with realistic setting of the Earth, you get 2 watts per square meter of about of power generation, or when you integrate it to the global scale, it's 900 terawatts. And this is actually something that, you know, when you look at observations, this is actually something that you observe. It's about this order of magnitude that the atmosphere actually generates and dissipates free energy, kinetic energy. And again, this is a maximum efficiency of 2%, of about 2%. So this is something you can call the state of maximum entropy production. You can also almost equivalently call it a state of maximum power generation. And when you look at the numbers, you just see, well, it actually fits really well with reality. I mean, it's, you know, the atmosphere couldn't do 1,800 terawatts or 20,000 terawatts because this is the maximum efficiency that you can extract power in steady state. I mean, this by itself, you know, tells you that, well, this is how much the atmosphere can extract. It doesn't probably need to do this, but the fact that it does, I think, for me, is a strong indication that it really does maximize. It arranges itself through turbulent processes to really maximize power extraction and dissipation and entropy production. So, and one way you can think of this mechanism is, so you have some radiative forcing that creates a heating gradient. So then you have a maximum here, or a variation of the power you can extract with the heat flux. So as soon as you start extracting power to generate motion, motion transports heat, sensible and latent heat, so it affects the heat flux. And so it would seem that the system just evolves here and then wobbles around this maximum. And what I find also really interesting is actually that this maximum here, this 2% efficiency, is actually something that is independent of material properties. So it doesn't, I mean, we had discussions at various MEP workshops on, you know, does it matter whether the atmosphere is made of vinegar or hot air or something. And this is, these 2 watts per square meter is independent of material properties. When you want to translate it into motion, then of course material properties matter. So, you know, I mean, if you have, I don't know, an atmosphere made of honey, then your velocities are probably a lot smaller because you can transport heat a lot more efficient. So then I probably just skip this one. I mean, you can have a simple model of showing that when you put power into the momentum balance, then you drive a momentum gradient and free energy, which is basically kinetic energy. And then actually you can then also have another simple model where you can show that when you have motion, you can extract again a maximum amount of work from the motion to do some other work, for example, lift up dust. So there you can also show that there's a maximum there. And so basically where this leads to is that I think it's important to view sort of power generation and disequilibrium in sort of a hierarchy within the Earth system. So you have some radiative forcing that leads to differential heating, and then you have an engine, the atmospheric engine, that feeds on this gradient, generates power, drives motion, and it actually exploits this gradient as good as it can. It maximizes power. And then it's almost like you can put a belt around this engine and drive some other process. For example, you can dehumidify the atmosphere, which also requires work being done. But it means that actually you transfer some of the power from motion into power to drive the dehumidifier. When you then have a water cycle that drives the transport of water to land, then you transport water to land where it can actually also perform work, and then again you have a transfer of power. So for example, then you have continental runoff, and continental runoff can, for example, you can dissolve minerals in the runoff, or you can transport sediments in suspension. But this all includes that you take power from one process and put it into some other process. And so you have sort of this cascade here from radiative gradients to motion, this kinetic free energy, water cycling, where you generate potential energy, to some geochemical cycling. And because you have inefficiencies at each step, you really deal with less and less power as you get to this point here. Okay, so you can think of this as a sort of, when you think of the whole planet, you can think about this as a hierarchy. So you have some forcing here, sort of at the outer shell of the onion, that then results in some forms of free energy that are further down in this hierarchy. And so once you transfer power here, you drive these different processes out of equilibrium, and so you cause disequilibrium. Same you can do with interior processes. We actually collaborate with an alliance that is with astronomers and planetary scientists, so we worked a bit on this too. So here you have heat generation by radioactive decay and by crystallization of the core that creates temperature gradients, causes mental convection. Mental convection then results with buoyancy in the cycling of oceanic and continental crust. And everywhere here, I mean, it's again, you know, you have a temperature gradient, you exploit this temperature gradient to generate motion, to extract power to generate motion that then can yield eventually some potential energy in form of topographic gradients that can then yield some also some chemical free energy in the system. So, and then when you think about feedbacks and interactions, I think it's really important to actually focus on this how from a thermodynamic perspective. I mean, I've done some work on atmosphere vegetation, atmosphere biosphere interactions, and so on. But you know, you usually look at precipitation and effects on temperature, but you usually don't look at how does it affect disequilibrium, how does it affect power generation or dissipative processes. Okay, so you can actually estimate how much power is being involved. This is sort of this one here, so this is the upper half of this onion. The atmospheric circulation, this is 900 terawatts from that simple estimate early on. I used the GCM to calculate that water cycling is about 558 terawatts. That's basically the work that you need to perform so that you have droplets in the clouds that then can dissipate that potential energy by rainfall. Evaporation of water over the ocean actually also performs work in that it desalinates water, so precipitation is not salty but is fresh water. Then you can use topographic gradients to actually infer how much is in continental runoff. This is a maximum of 13 terawatts, and then when you compare this water to how much work it can actually do to dissolve minerals, then this is actually coming up to less than 1 terawatt. And I think what is actually important here to note about this diagram is that the units here, I mean, if you convert this to watts per square meter, when you think about the climatologist's energy balance, you know, usually you deal with magnitudes of 240 watts of per square meter of net solar forcing. When you talk about the work or the power involved in climatic processes, it's a lot less. It's two orders of magnitude less. It's all in the order of 1 watt. Per square meter or less. So then I think I'll skip the next part. I mean, then you can actually do sort of simple models of MEP also in the interior of mantle convection, oceanic crust cycling, and continental crust cycling, and you find maxima everywhere and there. And that these maxima they can then use again to actually infer how much power is being involved in interior processes and geological processes that shape topographic gradients and continents and so on. And you notice that's a lot less, you know, so mantle convection with a simple, really simple model, we estimate 12 terawatts, oceanic crust cycling 28 terawatts. And so you can see it's a lot less than what the atmosphere does. But then actually, and this is now sort of getting more back to Lovelock and life on the planet, is that when you then think about photosynthetic activity, this photosynthetic activity does not rely on this chain, this inefficient chain of conversions, but it really starts right here from the source. It uses solar energy, it uses photons that can create electric energy by electronic absorption and create chemical free energy directly. And then when you do this, you calculate how much what the productivity is of the ocean biosphere and the terrestrial biosphere, and you convert this into a unit of free energy generation, then you come up with this 215 terawatt. And you notice how, I mean, this is a significant number when you compare to this. And I mean, this is the atmosphere only produces kinetic energy, and with chemical energy you can do a lot more than with kinetic energy. And when you compare this, for example, to the power that is involved in rainfall from freshwater on land that can dissolve rock minerals or change rock minerals, you can see that this is, I mean, this is two orders of magnitude larger than what you can generate by just purely physical processes. And then last but not least, you can also infer how much we humans actually consume power. And we consume power in form of we appropriate vegetation productivity. And there's some studies that about 40% of the terrestrial productivity is being appropriated by humans. You can convert this again in a power that we appropriate. This is 25 terawatts. This is the food we eat, essentially. And also primary energy consumption by fossil fuels. And that's 17 terawatt, I think it was last year. When you add this together, it's 42 terawatts. And you noticed 42 terawatts is more than what all geological processes can perform at maximum, right? And so when you put this in a bit in a historical context, actually, sort of 100 years ago, Russian scientist Vernadsky said that life is the geologic force. And you can see this, that this is the geologic force. And now when you think about Crutzen a few years ago said, you know, that we are hitting the Anthropocene, and you can say, well, yeah, I mean, humans are a geologic force. I mean, we are actually dissipating more energy than what the all of geology does. Okay, so I just want to quickly go over implications. The first bullet here is actually really short because I'm not really saying much about it. But I work with GCMs as well. But I think this idea that power is being transferred among different processes, I don't think this is really captured in the way we model climate processes and their interaction. If you're interested, I can give you some examples. Okay, one example. Okay, it's actually the transfer of momentum from the atmosphere into the ocean. So you have in the atmospheric boundary layer, you have winds. They exert a drag on the surface, and the way I understand this is you calculate your drag, you dissipate this momentum in the atmospheric boundary layer, and then you use the drag to force the ocean circulation, or the wind-driven ocean circulation. Now, some of that momentum should not be dissipated by turbulence, but should just be removed, because you have the transport or the transfer of momentum from the boundary layer winds into the surface ocean. So it reduces the momentum of the boundary layer, but it does not lead to turbulent fluxes. And at the moment, all momentum removal in the boundary layer results in turbulent fluxes. Does that make sense?
You mean it's double counted?
I think you overestimate turbulent fluxes, yeah. And if you want, you can do the same example over land, because there you don't have ocean, but you have like dust transport or wobbling canopies, you know. I mean, then again, you transfer momentum to stimulate some motion in the canopy, then it's then dissipated by frictional losses in the stems, but it does not result in turbulence. Does that make sense? To be discussed.
Yeah.
Okay. Perhaps you can. Okay, so so when you think about this again in terms of Gaia, so you have this tendency of processes to maximize power, and so with this you drive disequilibrium in the Earth system, and now life is a substantial power source for geochemical free energy. So I just put this here as 215 terawatts is much larger than 1 terawatt, And so this then connects with, you know, with Lovelock saying that chemical disequilibrium is in the Earth's atmosphere is due to widespread life, and this is a sign of habitability or habitated planet. And so, well, if you want an implication for this, well, when you look back at this diagram of how oxygen evolved through time, then, and that looks like that disequilibrium actually increased in time, then it actually, what it means is that this looks like that power generation over time has also increased in the Earth system. So just as a, put that there with a question mark. Now, when you think about human imprint or global change, again, I just put up these numbers here that they are significant. And so, you know, we have various issues of global change, global warming, deforestation, biodiversity loss, population explosion, food supply. You can name all your favorite issues of global change here. And we usually evaluate them in sort of changes in temperature, changes in radiative forcing, changes in the hydrologic cycle, perhaps. But we don't really think about it in terms of power. And to sort of make this, sort of illustrate this with in terms of cars, and this is here on the left, an East German sport car, and the right is a West German sports car. And if you want to characterize the difference between these cars, I don't think you would use the temperature of the engine, but you would rather use the power of the engine to differentiate these cars. And so when we think about Earth system change, how much does temperature tell us, and how much does changes in power tell us? And I just leave that as a question. Or actually, I give you one example where this really matters, and this is actually probably, it doesn't take long. It's about one student who is interested in renewable energy in an Earth system context, and so he was interested in wind power. So when we think about wind power, then, well, we have this hierarchy here. You know, we have a thermodynamic heat engine here, and then you have these power transfers to these other processes. And when you, and you can relate this to different forms of renewable energy. So for example, up here in this hierarchy, this is where you would generate solar power. Here you would extract wind power or wave power, ocean power that are related to wind. And down here you would deal with hydropower or osmotic power. Now, when you want to extract wind energy, then basically you put another belt on this engine. And of course you're going to slow it down, because if you already maximize, the atmospheres are organized to maximize power production, then you can only slow it down when you put another belt on the engine. And so you have that actually impacts are inevitable. And so what you find is that these are simulations with Klaus Friedrich's planet simulator, where we calculated global dissipation and how much wind power you can maximally extract. And what we come up with is that you can actually extract a lot less, and you are going to affect the climate system very clearly. I mean, these dots are all individual model simulations. Very clearly, you're going to reduce dissipation in the atmosphere as a very clear signal. While temperature differences are not very clear, I mean, it's getting warmer here and colder there, and it's all not statistically significant. And so when you think about this in terms of renewable energy, then with wind power extraction, you actually reduce the power availability and generation in the atmosphere. While when you think about putting solar panels in the desert, you know, you lower the albedo of the surface, and so that would seem like that you enhance the absorption of sunlight, and with this you actually increase power generation. This is also just a stimulation for some more ideas on that. So I want to stop here now. So the background, I talked about the link between thermodynamic disequilibrium and variability and how it relates to power generation. And I think in the context of what we heard about on Tuesday, I think this relates quite strongly on what potential limits on stochastic forcing actually you can have. Then I showed, you know, that the thermodynamic limit of power generation in the Earth system usually is a lot less than the Carnot efficiency, the maximum power generation, and that this maximum power generation corresponds very closely to MEP. Then I talked about how this applies to the Earth system in terms of a hierarchy of power generation and transfer, And I talked about this, well, I think I didn't spell it out, but it's really sort of a global work budget where you specify how much power is involved in different processes. And if you wanted sort of the missing budget, if you think about the two laws of thermodynamics, the first and the second, law deals with entropy. With that, you can generate an entropy budget. The first one combines heating and work. And when we talk about the global energy balance, we only talk about the heating terms, but we don't really talk about the work terms. And it's the work terms that cause disequilibrium. And then in terms of implications, well, I mentioned this potential issue that it's not adequately captured in current models. Then I talked about how life really generates a lot of chemical energy in the system, and humans consume a significant amount of power. And gave you this one example of how you can evaluate change by looking at wind energy in the Earth system. So thank you for your attention. And that's enough.
One thing, at the beginning, when you do the two box model of the climate system, this has been my recent concern about that. That if you do the calculation about the entropy production, say, you discover you get the number on the material entropy production of the Earth of 50 milliwatts per square meter per Kelvin. This is order of magnitude. But of these, about 1/10 is given by horizontal processes. So the large-scale heat transport that you take into account. Whereas the 90%, 45, is given by vertical processes. So convection and whatever you want. So what is something that is a question I've been thinking about is like, why is the large, where in the physics you have that it's the large-scale processes, like the one you, so the large-scale disequilibrium that gives you this number. And also, in the Earth system, we have two temperature gradients. One is between north and south. The other one is between surface and, say, top of the troposphere, just to make things simple. So, the scale, we think, is geometrical. So we think one is large because it's 10,000 kilometers, the other one is 10 kilometers. But, this is something...
I think that's a very good question. I think what might be the answer to that is that... when you talk about vertical processes, they can also show that you have a maximum of power you can extract.
Yeah.
You have the same trade-offs, except that the direction signs are a little less, a little different. So, you actually, it's not an eighth, but a quarter of the Carnot efficiency. I think vertical processes or vertical motion is something that is not reflected in the large-scale wind fields because it's regional or local scale convection. And so I think that's why the horizontal gradients are the one that matches with large-scale observations of, or the inferred generation with large-scale wind fields.
Fascinating talk, I must say. I enjoyed that very much. If I could go right back to your first picture where you showed the oxygen levels rising over geological time, is it possible to compare that graph with, let's say, the growth of biological activity?
Tim would have the right diagrams on this. It has much to do with the evolution, with the dominance of photosynthetic life.
Right. Okay.
And
the
colonization on
the
land,
yes.
And things like that.
And it coincides nicely with the oxygen increase?
Well, it's a bit more complicated.
Right.
Because, you first have to oxidize the crust and you need to have sufficient buildup of oxygen in the ocean before you can actually have an oxidizing atmosphere.
Right.
So there's a time lag there.
Yeah.
So there's, as far as I understand, some people think that photosynthesis already evolved 3.6 billion years ago.
Some do. 2.7, I think, others. So there you go, there's a big error bar on that.
It depends on how you talk to.
But at least 300 million years before what's called the Great Oxidation, which is the orders of magnitude change in the oxygen content of the atmosphere, around 2.4 billion years ago, and apparently irreversible, and quite clearly indicated by disappearance of what's called mass-independent fractionation of sulfur isotopes for the geochemists. So something that's only been really firmly discovered in the last 10 or so years, that hydrogen escape to space is net oxidizing the planet, and it's thought that that was actually could have been enhanced by a biologically created methane-rich greenhouse in this interval, after you have the kind of photosynthesis we're familiar with, making a very productive biosphere. You actually have a reducing atmosphere, but it sheds hydrogen to space at a rate that means it ultimately titrates the planet and contributes, as Axel's saying, oxidize these big reservoirs of the crust, and then the atmosphere flips.
Right, thank you. That's very helpful.
Thanks. This is absolutely great. I mean, I just want to add to the point that was made here a second ago about vertical versus horizontal gradients. I've been struggling with a sort of similar-ish problem to this for a while. I haven't even got nearly as far as you. I must come and talk to you about it. But wouldn't the vertical gradients affect the temperature at which heat is rejected from the system for the horizontal gradients? I mean, that's where I always get messed up. So how do you get past that and what you've done?
I don't. I mean, it's only a two-box model, you know.
Yeah, that's why I didn't. Yeah. Okay.
But I think when you. Yeah. Okay.
There's one here, actually.
Your 250 watts for the biosphere, is that power in or is that available power? Because Ben and Sherry was arguing that the vast majority of the power used by photosynthesis powering the power system, splitting water, and the rest of the sugar generation is only one part.
It's net, I believe. I mean, it's the gross rate of fixing sugar, or producing sugar.
So that includes the photosynthetic efficiency in it?
Well, I mean, if you go from solar radiation to sugar, then you would have some more inefficient, some.
So if you calculate that from the carbon fluxes or the sodium fluxes, the carbon fluxes, so I think it does include that relative inefficiency of photosynthesis.
We're not conclusive there, but we discussed sort of the efficiency of photosynthesis, you know, and that, you know, just sort of as a challenging thought, perhaps it's also at the end maximized, you know, the efficiency. Then you have to think about electronic absorption, and you can only absorb in a certain wave band, and but we haven't. Probably closer. I think we have factored 2 off the observed efficiency.
Perhaps a very naive question, but do you think if we went through all of your type of analysis, you would be able to get faster to what the true climate sensitivity and climate redundant CO2 is, say, waiting for high resolution, however else we might attempt to improve climate simulations, or just waiting to see what happens? That's very generic.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know even to the extent whether, you know, how global warming would affect power generation in the system. I would think it decreases it, but I'm not sure. So, good question.
You better answer that one.
When we formulate continuum models for fluid mechanical type systems, we impose entropy ideas, the second law, through various inequalities, as you showed there. I think it's called the Clausius-Duhem inequality that they use. And when you do it, in order to satisfy it, it leads to restrictions. For example, the conductivity has to be positive, the viscosity has to be positive, and so on. And then that inequality is automatically obeyed by the differential equations before you do any kind of discretization. So what I'm wondering is, you don't impose any maximization principle for entropy production in that system. Are you aware of any theorems, or perhaps somebody else is, where systems do actually maximize the entropy before you do any kind of discretization or approximation, that you could actually prove that in general for some continuum models? I'm not aware of it, but I wondered if you were.
In general, No, I'm not.
Sounds like that's crying.
Yeah.
If these relations you're talking about, including constitutive relations between fluxes and forces, can be derived in various ways. But one of the points is that they can be derived from the Maxent formalism itself. So I have a book here which has that. But so they are already reflective of our variational principle, which is the Maxent one, the basic one I use.
So if that's the case, when we do accurate finite difference modelling and so on, some of us try and conserve energy and so on, so-called symplectic schemes. So you try and make sure that you don't do that. So perhaps is it anybody devised a scheme that guarantees that it maximises the entropy?
And you know, it's the processes that do not follow the general equations, right? I mean, so a couple of years ago, we did a sensitivity with a climate model where we, you know, brave enough to vary the von Karman constant in the boundary layer scheme. And we found that the value of 0.4 maximizes entropy production. And I think that's because when you think about the boundary layer parameterization, it's not as fundamental as Navier-Stokes equation. And so it's sort of semi-empirical. And so, you know, you sort of tune, unconsciously, you tune it to actually to maximize entropy production, which in a way is consistent with what Roddy says. You know, you apply max end algorithm to actually infer how the dynamics should look like in differential, in form of differential equations. And so I think that's actually, in theory, how you could use this also to actually parameterize subgrid scale processes. But I say in theory because I don't know how you do it in practice.
Well, that's something I think would be great to discuss a bit this afternoon, this whole issue of whether these sort of principles help you with subgrid scale parameterization in order to explicitly try to simulate transport. Any other questions?
I see that from a few years ago, in this context, the word power transfer is used much more than entropy production. So it seems to me that the attention is going from entropy production to power. In your two-box model, you have shown that they are basically the same, they are parallel, they are mapping one to each other. Does it depend only on that model, or is that a general property?
I think it's...
So entropy production and power.
I mean,
it's not. Which one is more important?
I mean, the one thing is you assume, when you assume steady state, power equals dissipation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's your free energy balance in steady state. And then dissipation divided by temperature yields entropy production. And because when you deal with the Earth's surface, the variations in temperature are not that great. Yeah? So if you divide 1 over 300 or you divide 1 over 288, then it doesn't really make much of a difference, but it's still an approximation. It's not identical. And what I've found is that when you talk about power, it's more, you can grasp it better than entropy production. And since it doesn't seem to make much of a difference in practical terms, I mean, I think the fundamental direction should be, I think, related to entropy production, but in practical terms, it might just be easier to think about power. And apart from which, you can make nice wordplays like empower the planet, things like that.
Can I just ask a question about, maybe it's something to ask Roddy as well? Because I got the impression on Monday that you were suggesting that it needn't be entropy production that's maximized. Depends on the constraints. Is that right?
Yeah, there's no universal expression that works in all cases. It depends on the constraints that you deem are important on your physical system. And that depends on the system itself and on the scale at which you represent it in your model. And different resolutions, for example, will require more information to predict, of course. So there's no universal one. So in relation to Axel's hierarchy, one could envisage applying the general formalism I presented on Monday, in which at any given time and spatial scale, your processes are selected by MEP, subject to the constraints imposed by the slower processes on the longer timescales, and so on in a hierarchical fashion.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Axel.
Thank you.
We've now got a half an hour coffee break.